Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're talking about one of the deadliest promotional fiascos in marketing history that started with a $32 billion mistake and ended with a violent months-long uprising in the Philippines, U.S. President Bill Clinton being presented with a burning effigy of a giant Pepsi bottle, multiple bombings, and five deaths.
Oh my God.
That's right. We're going back to 1992 to talk about Pepsi number fever.
Pepsi number fever?
For this episode, our main source material was a long form article from Bloomberg Business Week by Jeff Maish with Barbara Resurrection and Nicole Ann Rivita. This was really actually the most comprehensive piece that I found out there. Mm-hmm. It's a really great article from kind of like an out-of-the-box source.
Okay.
But it's the most quoted article from most of the sources.
Cool.
I also read a little bit of Fizz, How Soda Shook Up the World, which is kind of a fun book by Tristan Donovan. And then there's a lot of inline sources that I kind of supplemented.
Great.
Wikipedia.
And also, of course. What are you saying? Pepsi number what? What?
It's a contest called Pepsi Number Fever. We'll get into it, man. I'll tell you all about it.
Pepsi
man.
Number Fever.
And also, before we finish up here, dude, mushroom update, guys.
Oh, okay. Mushroom update from Australia?
Yeah, from Australia.
Yeah.
You remember the lady?
Yeah.
Yeah. Erin Patterson? Well, I'm a little late. I meant to do this literally like 3 weeks ago. She totally did it. She
really?
Got charged. Well, she hasn't been convicted,
okay.
But she's been charged with feeding her in-laws those poison mushroom guys.
Yeah.
Of course she did. We all knew.
What about her husband?
There's a lot of stuff going down. They think that she poisoned him like a lot of times.
Yeah.
They're looking into a lot of stuff with her. But we'll keep on going with that.
Okay.
I'm sure you guys have seen that in the news, but I just wanted to say if anyone was curious, you know.
Well, I'm curious and I haven't seen it, so.
Well,
I appreciate the update.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of us had our eyes rolled up to the back of our head and we're like, obviously he did it. So unstick those eyes, guys.
Unstick them?
Yeah.
Okay.
She did it.
Okay. All right. Innocent until proven guilty. Unless you're Muriel, then she did it.
I mean, we all knew.
Okay. All right. It's the holiday season, baby. And if you're looking for the perfect gift that kills two birds with one stone, get yourself a subscription to the Muriel's Murders Patreon feed or Spotify exclusive feed. The first bird that you kill with that stone is that you get yourself a gift. And the second bird you kill with that stone is you give us the gift of your monetary support. And if you want someone else to get you a subscription as a gift, have them email us, murielsmurders@gmail.com, and we can help out with that easy peasy.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the gift that keeps on giving month after month. So sign up today. Patreon.com/murielsmurders. The link for that and the Spotify exclusive feed are in the episode descriptions of this episode. Damn, I'm good at ad reads. Okay. We got another beautiful 5-star review from username me2016 titled Always a Fun Listen. Quote, great podcast, very entertaining. Muriel and Nick are both amazing. Keep doing you. We love those Apple reviews. And if you happen to be listening now and you're hating on us, suck on that review, baby. You know what I mean? Thanks for the love, everyone.
Yeah, I feel like that was also a nice one for our Bad Rolling Stone one. They were being nice to us for that.
Yeah. Well, we love it when people are nice to
us. Yeah, that was really sweet. Thank you. All right. This is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So many listeners are like, Nick, and they don't want to hear about those kind of things. Go listen to a different podcast.
We're going to joke. We're going to curse. That might offend you. And I think you should turn us off, but actually maybe you shouldn't. I don't really know. In fact, definitely keep listening no matter what.
All right. Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay. Let's get started. All right. So, Casolini. You looked out, okay?
Okay.
I got pretty deep into researching this story before I realized it's not really a murder story.
Oh, okay.
It's right. More of a true crime-ish mixed with some wild-ass history I didn't know about. Uh-huh. Okay, so I've had this on my list forever, like for maybe a year.
Uh-huh.
I've been wanting to do it forever, and it is pretty interesting. I think it's, I was going to say fun, but I probably shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's so deep and complicated and surprising in ways that, unfortunately for your brain, are entertaining.
Yes.
Okay.
Anyway.
And in that way, it's fun.
I'm glad to tell you about this story.
Okay, good, good, good.
It's maybe a little out of the box for what we normally do, but I'm excited to tell you about it.
Let's do it.
And honestly, it's probably the perfect thing to listen to while you're getting ready to fight fools on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving, everyone. If you need to tune out and just, you know, get all of them away from you,
yeah,
just put us in your ears.
This,
you know,
is your Thanksgiving here, episode.
Oh, yeah, hell yeah.
Okay, so, Nick.
Yes.
Do you know about the Cola Wars?
The cola, like Coke versus Pepsi?
Yeah.
And how two things that are exactly the same seem to be in conflict with each other, like every other human.
Like you and me.
Human in existence. We're all the same, people. We literally all have the same flavor.
Okay, so like I think there are different eras of Cola Wars, like significant periods of bloody competition between fizzy beverage companies who make things I wasn't allowed to drink as a child.
Yeah, me either.
But we're going to begin with the great cola war of the 1980s between Coke and Pepsi,
mm-hmm.
as told by history.com and filtered through me. So arguably the cola wars of the 1980s began with something called the Pepsi Challenge. Do you remember this?
No.
You don't remember this? I remember this.
I don't know. What is it?
So Coca-Cola was like this American darling, right?
Uh-huh.
But back in 1975, Pepsi started doing the Pepsi Challenge, which was a blind taste test that showed the world it didn't matter who the popular kid was. They liked the taste of the nerd more, right? Pepsi kept winning these blind taste tests hands down over and over and over again.
Okay.
So obviously that was terrible for Coke. Coke is dying of embarrassment. They can't believe it. So Coke goes down in their laboratory and they take the greatest minds in soda and all of their resources and cash and magic and Eye of Newt, and they miraculously come up with a formula that beat both Pepsi and the original Coke recipe in their blind taste test, right? So yeah. They beat them at their own game. Ha! Nailed it. Coke is still king. The snake ate its own tail. Suck it, Pepsi. Okay? So Coke takes this miracle beverage, again, used its greatest minds to repackage it and come out swinging to dominate Pepsi once and for all and release their new beverage under the new name, New Coke. Brilliant. And that bold move almost killed Coke altogether, right?
All right.
Because despite people liking the taste of New Coke more in these blind tests, they were so emotionally attached to old Coke that they lost their minds. They raged against the brand. They were like, eliminate New Coke. Bring it back. Bring back our crappy old Coke or we'll burn you to the ground. So Coca-Cola, uh-huh. they heard its passionate and fickle fans loud and clear. And this event precipitated the birth of Coca-Cola Classic, which continued to dominate in its nostalgic mediocrity, just like the Rolling Stones. Kidding.
Kidding.
Obviously,
kidding.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
Anyway.
If you're a brand new listener, this is your first time, you don't know what that means, but maybe one day you'll find out. Okay.
One day you'll find out. Totally
scan that,
kidding.
Scan that back catalog, baby. Just like 50 Cent recording the hit single Candy Shop. Okay.
Okay. Anyway, after this, the knives were sharpened and the battle raged on, right? This mm-hmm. battle between Pepsi and Coke. in addition to new and better tasting formulas and crystal colored alternatives, came sweepstakes, prizes, and lottery style systems to bolster soda sales. And soon, Pepsi came out blasting with Pepsi Number Fever. The promotion rolled out first in the U.S. in its earlier forms to solid success, and then later ran in Mexico and different countries in South America. Pepsi Number Fever was the brainchild of Pedro Vergara, the youngest ever PepsiCo International CFO, and his secret weapon for planetary domination. Basically, the company just printed numbers on the inside of Pepsi bottle caps and then would call out the numbers on the nightly news or, you know, in different ways. So if your number was called, you got a cash prize. It was just basically like a lottery.
Uh-huh. What, like enough to get yourself another Pepsi?
Sometimes the prizes all vary, but sometimes they'd be really big.
Mm-hmm. We have to start videotaping these episodes and putting them on YouTube. I don't know if people can really tell just how freaky Muriel's getting with her physicality. She's like dancing around the table. Her arms are going crazy. It's just like you're actually entertaining to watch.
I don't need you to be telling my secrets.
Okay, great.
All right. So where was I?
Lottery.
All right. So the program, huge success. People like money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And soon, in the early 90s, Pepsi had its sights on its white whale, the Philippines. So according to the book Fizz, at the time, the Philippines was one of the world's largest consumers of carbonated beverages. And Coca-Cola, evil Coca-Cola, right, according to Pepsi, had the Philippines tightly gripped in its cold red fingers. Pepsi and Coca-Cola had been at war in the Philippines for years, starting back in the 1980s. So back in the 80s, during the reign of dictator Ferdinand Marcos, Pepsi had the lion's share of the market, and the two companies were just like going off on each other, largely unchecked by any like laws or rules or whatever. For instance, they would do things like run around and steal each other's reusable glass bottles. And then they would hoard them and then hilarious. Go dump them in empty fields to try to hide them so they could drain the other person's marketing budgets. So they would have to pay for more glass bottles instead of advertising.
So basically these huge multinational conglomerate companies, corporations, whatever, were just doing like petty pranks on each other in countries where they couldn't get in trouble for it.
Yeah, basically. And a lot of the time what they do is they partner with local subsidiaries. So they wouldn't be working with the same budget, for instance, as like the huge markets. So they'd be fighting these wars with these smaller budgets and smaller factions on the ground. So a lot of like this story, for instance, they're fighting with these people who've partnered with Coke and Pepsi on the ground. That makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it's very interesting. So towards the end of the decade, though, after all this stealing bottles, dumping them in fields, Pepsi dominating, Coke brought in the Kraken, a tall, redheaded Northern Irish executive called Neville Isdell, who put together a sales force in the Philippines nicknamed the Tiger Force after the Eye of the Tiger song.
Okay, good.
He got that from Rocky. So he joined forces with a team already on the ground at the Coca-Cola partner CCBI that was headed by Jesus King Celderon, who was a beloved local figure. So they had these two guys working for Coke. One was this big, tall, redheaded Irish guy.
Yeah.
And then this other guy whose nickname was King, who was this like tiny Filipino dude. Yeah. And they would work together. And what they would do is they decided they were going to use this military theme to pump up their sales force to just dominate Pepsi.
Oh,
so they
no.
would get dressed
oh, this
up.
Kid, this is never going to go well.
So they get dressed up like generals and they'd walk into the room and start smashing glass Pepsi bottles on the ground.
Walk into what room?
Like executive. Like
oh, to get their meetings. Team members fired up.
Yeah.
Oh,
and bottling plants, they would go in and they would just be like screaming and acting like generals. And in fact, I found this article written by Barbara Gonzalez Ventura. She wrote a piece for the Philippine Star when King King passed away just recently, a few years ago. She used to work with King King and Isdell back in the day. She said the pair actually bought all of their executives' military uniforms, and they would get really pumped up about it and like ask them to buy them different medals and pins and decorative like flags and stuff like that. And what they would do is they would take these tours of all the bottling plants. And before they would take the tour, they'd have people go out and decorate all the bottling plants with sandbags, camouflage, netting. And then back then they could borrow tanks and military jeeps the military. And so they would go with all the executives in these parades and go from bottling plant to bottling plant and just be like, we're at war with Pepsi.
We are the army.
Yeah. They would be like, this is it. So they would just make them look like war zone and get everyone like pumped up to battle with Pepsi. And they would like jump out of these tanks and be like screaming, like smashing Pepsi bottles. Yeah. And it totally worked. I mean, mostly it worked because they undercut Pepsi's prices by this insane amount.
Yeah, yeah.
But according to Bloomberg, by 1992, Coke held 83% of the cola market share. Like so much of the cola market share, they didn't even have to advertise in the Philippines anymore. There was just nothing left.
It's just like we're less of the military and more of the dictatorship here.
It was amazing. So while all this wacky cola stuff was going on in the Philippines, actually, the Philippines were just in this moment of upheaval. So like while all of this is going on, you know, the Marcos era had, you know, just ended in 1986. So that was 20 years of dictatorship filled with martial law, human rights abuses, state-sanctioned murders, imprisonment of like tens of thousands of dissidents, and then the tanked economy. And then after 1986, the wife of an assassinated opposition leader to Marcos took power. Her name was Corazon Aquino, and she became the 11th president of the Philippines. And she did a ton of great stuff, right? She created a new permanent constitution, limiting presidential terms so nobody could take 20 years, right? She limited the presidential power to declare martial law. She restored a bunch of democratic institutions. But things were still really wildly unstable. So while you know, Pepsi and Coke are duking it out in this crazy mock war. You know, there were six unsuccessful military coups during her term. And then on top of that, there were these unprecedented natural disasters. So in 1990, there was this horrible earthquake on the island where Manila is located, which is the, you know, the capital of the country. And so that killed 2,000 people.
Whoa.
And then the next year, Mount Pinatubo erupted. And that was literally the second most powerful volcanic eruption of the entire 20th century in the world.
Wow.
So out of that 100-year period.
Right.
And that, I saw a bunch of different numbers, but from what I can tell, it looks like about 1,000 people were killed. 2 million people were affected by that eruption, and about 200,000 people were left homeless or displaced. And that's according to Wikipedia numbers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what that means is like by 1992, when our story takes place, you've got all of this crazy political upheaval and then these natural disasters that totally force people out of their homes. And our story takes place, you know, a lot of it takes place in and around Manila. And you know, you've got five like massive like huge slums around that area where people have like forced into these slums, you know, and don't, you know, just huge populations in flux and all of this stuff going on. So it's like a wild time.
It's crazy
in the country's history.
It's crazy.
And then this is when this event happened.
This
is when Pepsi came to town promising to make everyone a millionaire.
What, with the lottery thing? But people, were people really winning millions from the lottery number thing?
Let's get into
it. Okay.
The contest started in February 1992. So inside bottle caps would be a number printed from 001 to 999. And if your number was announced, you could redeem the bottle cap for cash prizes ranging from 100 pesos, so that was around $4 US at the time, to the grand prize of 1 million pesos. That would be about 40,000 US dollars in 1992 money.
That's legit.
Yeah. And according to Bloomberg, at the time, 1 million pesos was around 611 times the average monthly salary in the Philippines. So like 50 years worth of wages. So a really significant amount of money, mm-hmm. despite like the, what's that called? Like,
I don't know. You're doing funny hand motions. Start the sentence again.
The thing, not transfer, like the
exchange rate.
Yeah. Despite okay. the exchange rate, okay. it's still like a very, very significant amount of money.
Good hand gestures. For
Stop
that
it. And add to that, the published odds of winning were about 1 in 28 million, right? Mm-hmm. But in the first few weeks, they rapidly gave away about 18 grand prizes. So with a population of 65 million, it didn't take a super genius to get a sense that things were looking pretty freaking good in terms of becoming a millionaire, you know, compared to the usual odds of, let's say, the average national lottery.
Sure.
It just seemed, I think the... For instance, Powerball, the odds of winning are about 1 in 300 million.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it was pretty, they were like, wow, this is really happening. You know, it's really going. And not only that, Pepsi's ads were really compelling. They ran fresh ads starring all the recent grand prize winners as soon as they won. So it made everything seem all the more in reach for the average Joe. The most popular ad starred a bus driver called Nina Balmes, aka Mrs. Pepsi, who was like, oh yeah, you know, Pepsi sexually aroused her husband was basically the joke.
Yeah. See, I would say, man, for in the 90s in America, Pepsi ads were sexually arousing.
They
little,
had all the big
little boy Nick. Like they had all the hot.
They had like Beyonce.
Well, that was later, but yeah. And then like they had Britney Spears when she was hot, but even earlier than that.
Well, they had Michael Jackson was the big one.
Yeah. They always had like dope ass cool. They were like the hip young, like teenage one. And Coca-Cola was like, hey, we're your grandparents drinking.
Yeah,
so
right.
Hanging out
right.
in a convertible. It's like, forget the convertible. I want to see a nighttime scene that takes place in an alley.
Wasn't
you know?
It like Generation Now or there? Yeah, right. It was the same
anyways.
Thing.
Yeah.
Takes place in an alley, man.
I'm trying to see some, you know, someone climb a fence with a Pepsi in their hand, you know?
All right.
With like cut off jean shorts and a skateboard.
So the promotion was a success of apocalyptic proportions.
Oh, no.
Monthly Pepsi sales immediately jumped 50% from like 10 million to 14 million. And their market share of the soda game jumped, you know, from 19% to close to 25% almost overnight. Pepsi had to double production. And people were out there stealing bottle caps, hoarding them like a darker Willy Wonka thing. According to Bloomberg, two sales clerks were murdered over Pepsi bottles, so things were getting kind Whoa. Of frantic.
Also, Willy Wonka was pretty damn dark, Muriel.
I know.
I don't know if it's darker than Willy Wonka, because he's killing children, isn't he? And he's just like...
Things are very... Yeah,
okay, Wonka. It's basically Willy Wonka. Yeah. Okay.
Pepsi Number Fever was so successful, it was estimated at one point half the population of the Philippines was participating, making it the most successful marketing campaign in the world at the time. And Coke was obviously looking at their completely nuked battlefield, stunned, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus King Celderon even took a break from riding his tanks to publicly admit he was concerned.
Yeah.
The promotion was scheduled to end on May 8th, but things were going so great, Pepsi opted to just extend the thing 5 more weeks. Why not? They were finally winning.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing. I'm not going to go too deep into like the complicated politics and colonialist like history of the Philippines. I'm not qualified, obviously, or smart enough. But I really want to mention broadly that this was just a really wild time and place to fuck up a corporate-sponsored millionaire contest. Okay? So 3 days after Pepsi extended their promotion and about 2 weeks before Pepsi made their really, really big oopsie, the Philippines had a significant presidential election with pretty wild themes given their recent and overall history as a people. So in this presidential election, the three top candidates out of seven candidates were right-leaning Fidel Ramos, who was a graduate of West Point with strong ties to the U.S. military. And we'll get to this later, but there was this really major thing going on where the Philippine Senate had just recently rejected a treaty with the U.S. that ended 100 years of U.S. military presence in the Philippines and closed the last of the U.S. military bases on Philippine soil. So there was a lot of like controversial big energy around this particular candidate. Mm-hmm. And then you had progressive Miriam Defensor Santiago, who was this brilliant Filipino lawyer. She was educated in the U.S., and she worked for the UN. She had this really long history of serving in government. And she had this thing where, like, the year prior, while campaigning for this election, she had almost been killed when her car was rammed while she was parked on a tarmac. And no one was charged in that. Mm-hmm. But she publicly considered it an assassination attempt. So there was, mm-hmm. like, a lot of stuff around that, right? And then finally, another leading candidate was billionaire Eduardo Kawango Jr., who is chairman of San Miguel Corp, which happened to be a partner of Coca-Cola in the Philippines. And Kawango Jr. also had very close ties to dictator Ferdinand Marcos, with his hands allegedly in all kinds of really terrible things that he never got in trouble for. Mm-hmm. So elections were held and the ballot counting was really sluggish. For the first 5 days of vote tallying, Miriam Defensor Santiago was ahead until the country suffered a series of nationwide power blackouts. So they had these rolling power blackouts. And then after the power was restored, Fidel Ramos, our right-wing West Point guy, magically won the election by a remarkably slim margin. In fact, he won the presidency with the lowest percentage of votes in the country's history. Mm. And after the election, the phrase, Miriam won in the elections but lost in the counting, was all the rage. It still mm-hmm. is today. Mm-hmm. So then, on May 25th, 1992, days after the controversial elections were concluded, Pepsi Number Fever once again dominated the airwaves. So at 6 p.m., about 70% of Filipinos tuned in to the Channel 2 evening news to see if they had a winning bottle cap. The number was announced, 349. Two caps had been printed with the number. They had been meticulously kept under lock and key until the appropriate time, then released and randomly distributed, just like clockwork. The only problem was, remember, the contest had been extended 5 weeks, right? Well, before the contest had been extended, about 800,000 caps.
No, with 349
had
on
been
it.
Printed.
Oh, no.
With the number 349. And no one from Pepsi had caught the mistake.
Oh, it's like when Steve Carell put the Willy Wonka thing in every shipment of paper that he sent out.
Yeah. So instead of giving away $80,000 US that night like they had planned, Pepsi had just accidentally given away $32 billion.
No.
Now, here's the caveat, okay? Each winning cap also had a corresponding security code printed on the cap as well. Mm-hmm. Now, according to Oliver Tevis for the Washington Post, this is where the legitimate beef came from when it came to the perspective of the consumers. So this is kind of how to break this down. Mm-hmm. Every cap in the contest had a security code on it that determined its authenticity. So all 80,000 people who had a 349 cap also had an authentic, legit security code printed on their cap, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that the two winning caps also happened to have a special winning security code that sure. corresponded with it. But nowhere in any of the promotional materials did it ever say that winners needed a quote unquote winning security code to collect their prize. All it said is you needed an authentic cap and a winning number.
Yeah.
And that's what they had.
Right.
Right. But even this is just getting a little technical, right? The point is, in this moment, on the evening of May 25th, 1992, 800,000 people across the Philippines had a fully, completely legitimate reason to believe they were a goddamn millionaire. Yeah. Not wishful thinking,
yeah, yeah.
Not some sort of like rose-colored glasses mistake.
Yeah.
They had a fully authentic bottle cap with an official security code from one of the biggest companies in the world, a number announced on the official national news. This was it. People were winning all over the country. I mean, the odds were practically, like with 65 million people,
yeah.
The odds were practically 1 in 80 that someone that night could be a millionaire. And some people had more than one winning bottle cap. People were sifting through their box of caps finding like three 349s. According to Bloomberg.
No. This is just after they all feel cheated or whatever
from
about
the election.
Yeah.
According to Bloomberg, one mother of 12 who was going through a case of Pepsi a day had $35 million worth of winning caps.
Oh, damn. And none of them are real?
One of the places you could cash your winnings in was a bottling plant outside of Manila in Quezon City. And that night, people surged the locked iron gate looking to collect. The bottling plant secretary, Rosemary Vera, called the local marketing director and was like, hey, you know, just FYI, there's a lot of people here. And just so you know, like I personally, I know a lot of people with 349 caps. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Like, this is going on.
And I have one with me, actually.
By 10 p.m. that night, a rep from PepsiCo called the Philippine Department of Trade and Industry to report a mistake. So overnight, thousands flooded Pepsi bottling plants to claim their prizes. Factory gates were locked in Quezon City. By morning, PepsiCo tried to backtrack, saying, oops, actually, guys, the winning number was actually 134. That just made things worse,
right?
By mid-morning, people went from trying to collect their money politely to tackling security guards and throwing rocks at the factories, with Philippine PepsiCo partners frantically trying to reach their American counterparts on the phone. After an emergency 3 a.m. meeting on the 27th, executives decided to offer 500 pesos, which is about $18, to the holders of mistakenly printed bottle caps as a consolation prize. So close to 500,000 people accepted the deal, costing PepsiCo about $9 million. And just FYI, PepsiCo's entire budget for this particular promotional project was just $2 million. So that was kind of a hard pill to swallow, especially because that still left hundreds of thousands of other people who were just like, actually, come at me, bro. Give me my $1 million like right now.
Yeah.
So people were just straight up started rioting in the streets, right? It wasn't like a one and done thing. This unleashed something in the hearts of people that literally lasted years. The conflict took on two forms. There was like the litigation and grassroots organization and just straight up rage against the machine style burnings. and the litigation was sort of led by a Catholic lay preacher called Vicente Del Fierro Jr. He's a really interesting character. I just wanted to tell you about him. So he was an anti-Pepsi fever guy from the start. He hated gambling for religious reasons. So he sort of originally came to the protests, I think, as an I told you so sort of thing. The protests, it seems, were way more drastic than he thought they were going to be, but sort of validating in I told you the apocalypse was coming, empire will destroy us, find Jesus sort of way.
Sure.
Anyway, he showed up to see PepsiCo guards smashing bottles on protesters, people throwing rocks, riot shields, people with automatic weapons. And he was just like, what is happening? And Del Fierro Jr. ran for cover with the crowd of furious 349 winners into a nearby Dunkin' Donuts. And from these pink-walled windows, he watched Pepsi delivery trucks thundering in like a military fleet and saw this you know, colonial capitalist David and Goliath battle unfurling in front of him. And while he had no stake in the Pepsi number Fever Money himself, because he never played it, he felt a calling to organize his fellow people against this mega giants. So Vicente Del Fierro Jr. founded Coalition 349 with the help from an enthusiastic supporter. Jesus King King Celderon.
Mr. Coca-Cola.
Then executive vice president of Coca-Cola Beverages Philippines.
Come on, father.
Who donated 10,000 pesos and a megaphone with a PA system to his cause. With his Coca-Cola-backed coalition, the preacher led charismatic rallies outside Pepsi plants and prepared class action lawsuits on behalf of bottle cap holders. Meanwhile, others chose the Molotov cocktail route.
I like how they're like, Pepsi or Coke? They're like, how about a Molotov cocktail? Less sweet, more hot.
They set delivery trucks on fire or simply rolled them over. The huge sensation basketball team, the Pepsi-Cola Hotshots, changed its name to the 7-Up Uncolas. You know, people were going hard. They were super mad.
That's so weird and funny. Okay.
According to Bloomberg, at a riot...
7-Up Uncolas? Could they just change their name? Were they sponsored by Pepsi? Or is the same company owned 7-Up that owns Pepsi?
Probably I think it's the same company.
Sure, that I guess makes sense.
They were just...
I like how that same company is like also like, yeah, you're right, guys. Pepsi sucks. 7-Up Uncolas.
According to Bloomberg, at a riot in Manila, 64-year-old Paciencia Salem, whose husband had died of heart failure during one of the protests, told reporters, quote, even if I die here, my ghost will come to fight Pepsi.
Oh, damn. I believe her, too. I don't know why. I can just see her. I just believe her.
Yeah. At the end of 1992, with Pepsi protests still raging, the Philippine government ended all U.S. military presence in the country for the first time in 100 years.
Pepsi's like, please, no. Can you guys stay a while?
Senate rejected a treaty that would have extended U.S. military presence for 10 more years in exchange for $2 billion in aid. Instead, the U.S. left, vacating its last bases and, according to William Brannigan for the Washington Post, left $3 billion worth of facilities, toxic waste, and thousands of children of servicemen left behind. This left the people with a huge mixed bag of complicated stuff with hopes for future progress. Economic progress, a huge commercial port city, like who knows? Mm-hmm. But they were in charge of the ship. As we move into 1993, things decidedly did not chill out for Pepsi. While Vicente Del Fierro Jr. ran Coalition 349 in a fairly altruistic fashion, all these copycat organizations sprung up. There was United 349, Solid 349. They all started popping up, but started charging membership fees and demanding percentages of future payouts.
Oh my God. Just people trying to capitalize.
People were treating their potential payouts like payday loans too. So they were like selling valuables to get to Manila so they could cash in when Pepsi settled their lawsuits. There were even speculators. So people were running around paying huge amounts of money for 349 caps, hoping for a payout later. And while all this scamming is going on, there's tire burning, death threats to PepsiCo executives. There were evacuations of American employees. All of these PepsiCo people had to hire teams of bodyguards. There were Pepsi boycotts. And then came the bombs. In February 1993, a woman and five-year-old girl were killed when a homemade bomb bounced off a Pepsi delivery truck and hit them instead.
Oh, no.
Pepsi gave the woman and Sita Rosario's family 50,000 pesos, about $1,600 U.S., to compensate for her death. And then the next month, in March, three factory workers were killed at a Pepsi plant in Davao City when protesters tossed a grenade inside the factory.
Oh, my God.
So.
R.I.P. That's just, I mean, obviously just such useless death.
Yeah.
I mean, not that any death is, I don't know, useless maybe is the wrong word, but senseless? I don't know. That's so intense.
So from Pepsi's perspective, the Pepsi number fever fiasco was escalating beyond anyone's wildest dreams, actually. And instead of fizzling out, it was like somehow just getting worse and worse. It was completely unbelievable. And also now, the preacher and Coalition 349 was suing PepsiCo for like $400 million. And back in the States, people all over the country were finding, wait for it, used syringes in their cans of Pepsi.
What?
That's right. In 1993, an elderly couple in Tacoma, Washington reported finding used hypodermic needles in their canned Pepsi. And then they started popping up all over the country. Crack vials, broken sewing needles, blobs of brown goop, a bullet.
Was it like one person doing it or lots of people in the factory? Who was doing it?
Mostly used hypodermic needles.
Oh.
There were complaints spanning over 20 states.
Who? What?
The company looked into a bottling plant in Washington State where the complaints originated.
Yeah, on Rainier Avenue, right in our neighborhood. There's a Pepsi bottling plant right there.
And the FDA went in and agreed with the company that there was just no way the objects could have gotten into the cans at the plant. The process was just too fast and too streamlined. So it had to be a case of consumer tampering. Pepsi then released a statement instructing consumers to pour their Pepsi into a glass before drinking it and they should all be fine.
That's not a good answer.
But people were like, no, bro, that turned into a whole big fiasco in itself. They were like, that doesn't solve the problem.
Wait, where in Washington State? Was it the one on Rainier Avenue?
No,
do you know?
Wasn't. No. It wasn't. It was in like Seattle. It was more north.
Okay.
Eventually, though, in Colorado, a woman was caught inserting a syringe into a can on surveillance in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, the whole thing turned out to be this very strange national spontaneous hoax. So it turned out the original complaint, I don't think they figured out what happened, but after that was publicized, like some people started doing it to see if they could extort money from PepsiCo. Other people were just being creepy copycats. But the more it was publicized, the more hysteria grew and the more people did it. And somehow that just made it seem like it was this huge organized problem.
That sounds a little bit like that movie Dream Scenario. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's definitely interesting and worth a watch.
Yeah.
And basically it's just about this one man who keeps popping up in people's dreams and suddenly it's this national and then international phenomenon. That'd be a crazy spin on that idea to do a movie where just like people are just like, I should put things inside Pepsis just across the country. They're poisoned with that weird idea.
It's kind of what happened, right?
That's
so
crazy.
Like while all this stuff is raging in the Philippines, this is what's happening in the U.S.
Pepsi's like, can we just do something? And then they have when does Michael Jackson get lit on fire?
Then at the exact same time. No. But this is the thing. This is how it goes. At the exact same time, in August of 1993,
August of 1993?
Yeah, because we're all in 1993.
Sorry, you said it
weird. At the same time, in August of 1993, decade-long spokesperson for Pepsi and King of Pop megastar Michael Jackson was accused of child sex abuse.
Oh my. Yeah.
So by the end of 1993, Michael Jackson would cancel his Dangerous World Tour and publicly admit his addiction to painkillers that was in part caused by, wait for it, Pepsi.
Yeah.
So way back in 1984, when Jackson was 25 and like at the height of everything after Thriller and Off the Wall albums had been released, he signed this lucrative endorsement deal with Pepsi. Mm-hmm. And his first spot would be in front of a live audience with fireworks and dancers on this huge soundstage singing Billie Jean, but with cool Pepsi-inspired lyrics. And the fireworks malfunctioned, caught his hair on fire, burned his hair off, and then covered his scalp in second and third degree burns. Jackson said he started on painkillers during his scalp reconstruction surgeries. And after he was accused of child sex abuse over the summer, his addiction to painkillers spiraled out of control.
Wow. And wasn't Don King involved in that Pepsi ad? Remember? I think from our Don King.
Oh, I think he was involved
in that. He like set that up. Anyways. Yeah.
So Pepsi released Michael Jackson from the sponsorship deal at the end of 1993, ending this like decade-long partnership with the king of pop.
God, it's funny to think of Pepsi, you know, which is just a giant corporation, which I'm not against their products, but also it is just sugar that, you know, is literal poison for humans, as delicious as it is. But it's just funny to think of them as like a weird underdog in this scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like the
poor
worst.
Pepsi.
I mean, it's just like a, I don't think of it as value, or I don't know. I don't think of it as poor Pepsi, but like what a year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's just such a crazy, that's a crazy year.
Yeah.
Back in the Philippines, the National Bureau of Investigation, which is basically, I think, their version of the FBI, you know, the, you know, whatever, launched an investigation into the Pepsi bombings and found, wait for it, Pepsi may have actually bombed itself.
No.
The MBI reported a group known as the Three Kings were responsible for the Pepsi bombings. One of the men, Rodelio Fermento, a garment factory worker, did an interview with the NBI, and they told investigators that he had been recruited from a 349 group, one of these offshoot groups, and invited into a secret meeting. And that at that meeting, which included a Pepsi security guard, he was paid to cause violence at rallies and frame protesters, like the 349 protesters, as well as seed discontent among leadership in the 349 groups. He said he came forward because he felt guilty for those who got hurt and who were killed. Pepsi's lawyers dismissed the claims, but the NBI stood by its report, and headlines in the Philippines ran with the NBI's version of events. No criminal charges came from this, though. In fact, nothing really came of any of this aside from, you know, paying a few nominal fines and settling some minor lawsuits. Pepsi pretty much got off scot-free. In November 1993, then U.S. President Bill Clinton paid a state visit to the Philippines and was greeted by hundreds of 349 winners screaming for help, swinging torches around, and burning a giant mock Pepsi bottle filled with fireworks. But as cool as that sound, it didn't really do anything. After literally just embarrassing the shit out of the company, Crystal Pepsi was pulled from all markets in early 1994. Then in spring 1994, the preacher Vicente Del Fierro Jr. had a stroke and then another after the company sued him for libel for calling the Pepsi number fever promotion a scam. Then that spring, a court in New York dismissed the 349 Coalition's $400 million lawsuit, claiming it should instead be filed in the Philippines. Finally, in 2006, all remaining lawsuits fizzled out with no major losses for Pepsi. In a win for the 349s, though, Pepsi lost all its gains in the Philippines, and 349 is still used as slang in the Philippines for being scammed.
Pepsi, man. Really, really flew too close to the sun.
They did. They got greedy. They got burned, man.
Damn. Thank you so much to everyone who listened and is still listening now. It's amazing. Muriel did all the research. She wrote the whole thing. She acted it out just literally only for me. It was a one-woman show. And we got to set up video cameras. Every other stupid podcast does it. One day we will. And then, I don't know. You guys are the best. Oh, I do the editing and recording, blah, blah, blah. You know all that. Support the show, Patreon, Spotify. You know that. Leave us reviews. You know that. Send this to your loved ones. You know what I mean?
Hey.
What?
Happy Thanksgiving, man.
Happy Thanksgiving, man. All right. Be good to each other and yourself. R.I.P. Jerry Springer. That's it. We love you guys very much. Mario did our music. You know that. And, yeah, man. Bye.
Bye.